Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we're looking back at The Reading Life in 2022 in the second of two programs, this one devoted to nonfiction. Just as 2022 brought us memorable fiction and poetry, nonfiction was strong as well. We traveled the world with Jamie Attenberg, journeyed down the Mississippi with Rinker Buck, learned about the state bird from Ryan Fertel, and got a behind-the-scenes look at the musical life of Grammy-nominated Scott Billington. Those are just a few of the fascinating books that came our way. Here are some of the highlights. Critically acclaimed novelist Jamie Attenberg turned inward with the memoir I Have Come All This Way to Meet You, a moving, searingly honest look at a writer's inner life. Now, underneath it all, well, not that far underneath it all, but through it all, is this really rich spiritual context. You pray a lot. You pray a lot for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You write a lot about what it's like to be a post-Holocaust Jewish woman living in America. And you come face to face with haunting things. So talk about your love of the haunted. No wonder you ended up here in New Orleans.
I know. I feel strangely, it made me feel very at home and comfortable to be here. Well, I did see a ghost once. And
right.
That was sort of the starting point of my interest in it. It wasn't that I didn't believe in ghosts before then, but I certainly did believe in them after I did see that ghost. And that was probably about 12 years ago, something like that. It was sort of, you know, it was one of the most terrifying things that I'd ever seen, but it was also the most fascinating thing. And it's sort of, you once you see it, I don't know if you've ever seen a ghost before, Susan, or had
Alas,
any.
No. But I believe in them.
You do, yeah. And so it was like, once you see it, you can't unsee it. And then you have this awareness that it's sort of, the world is sort of different than you thought it was before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that I would say really, truly occupies my life on a regular basis, but it is. I'm not a ghost hunter.
No, I don't think so.
Yes, I have plenty of other things to do also. But I did do a lot of traveling and thinking about it when I would go to these places. And I think it's really important to kind of honor the past and think about who was there before you and think about whose land you're on, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so it all sort of came together for me when I was writing this book. I didn't have some huge catharsis about myself when I was writing this book, but I saw all the links,
yeah,
right, to that when I was writing this book. I didn't go out in the world and think, I'm going to go to all these haunted places so that I can write a book. But when I wrote a book, I saw that I had gone to all these haunted places.
Yeah, that wonderful hindsight when you see, oh, it all really adds up.
It all adds
to something
up.
Big.
Yeah.
You know? So talk a little bit about the bone chapels that you, the ossuaries, and the catacombs. You originally wanted to call this book The Bone Chapel.
I did want to call it The Bone Chapel because I think when I started to put things together, I thought maybe that's what this book is really going to be about because I was noticing all the patterns. Actually, it was also going to be called A Trip to the End of the World, which is the title
right.
of another chapter. And then there was a couple more titles in there. But each time I did a new draft with a new title, the book kind of changed a little bit because I was like leaning into whatever the main theme was. But anyway, the Bone Chapel, there is a bone chapel in Évora, Portugal that I went to. It was really quite thrilling. It was just like one of the most spectacular places I've ever been. It was just this elaborate display. I think it was like 16th century or something like that. And mm-hmm. it wasn't meant to scare you. The original
right.
intention of it wasn't meant to scare you. It was actually meant for you to stop and reflect on life, right? One thing that I learned from these travels is you can be afraid of death if you really want to be afraid of death. You know, you can do what you will with your mortality issues, but as long as you understand that you shouldn't waste your time while you're
right.
here, you know, Like, that's kind of what I learned. Like, it's about honoring the past, but it's also about honoring your present, too.
Well, that's why New Orleans is so perfect, because it's the ultimate memento mori of cities.
Yes.
You know, you're thinking about it all the time.
Yes.
You're accepting death every day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very unusual place.
It is, because it's all, yeah, it's just all kind of, it's built into it, right? It's all around you all the time, so. But also, this is a city that tells you to embrace life.
Yep. In his memoir, Making Tracks, Scott Billington gives us a new appreciation for what goes into the hunt for music.
I had always been drawn to New Orleans music. Oh, Professor Longhair, Fats Domino,
yeah.
That music resonated with me. And later I found out that some of the records I'd heard on the radio as a kid that hit records, you know, Something You Got by Chris Kenner or Working in a Coal Mine, Lee Dorsey.
Yeah.
I didn't really know they were from New Orleans, but when I found out, it was like, okay, that makes sense. Well, two friends who had a band in Boston, Vic Shepard and Karen Conearth, had moved to New Orleans because mm-hmm. they wanted to be closer to this music. So I started visiting them here. My very first night in New Orleans, I played with them on Bourbon Street for $10 a set.
Epic.
And then everything just started opening up. I went to Jazz Fest in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And where other areas of America... Oh, I think of Appalachia and the bluegrass
sure.
music, or Chicago with blues and so forth. There were fairly active recording scenes that were documenting the older musicians and making recordings of new players as they came along. But New Orleans was sort of wide open at that point. It was mm-hmm. in a real lull as far as recording was concerned. Alan Toussaint's great run of records and Sea Saint
yeah.
was kind of winding down at that point. I just started thinking, well, maybe we can make records here. The writer Jeff Hanisch introduced me to quite a few of the musicians that I ended up working with, Johnny Adams and Irma Thomas. I met James Booker through his manager, John Parsons. The first time I met him was just backstage at Jazz Fest.
Again, epic.
Yeah. It was just astonishing that I could walk up to these people,
people
and
yeah.
you know, introduce myself and say, I'd love to make a record with you. Would you be interested? And they would say, oh, sure. Yeah, let's do it.
Rinker Buck, a great American adventurer, gave us an unforgettable Mississippi River journey in Life Along the Mississippi, an epic American adventure. Now, first and foremost, let me say how very glad I am you didn't die during this adventure. You faced down a lot of doomsayers.
Yes, everyone told us we were going to die, from everything to running into barge traffic, tugs pushing, you know, 30 and 40 barges at once, pushing us against the walls of the river Edmonds along the river, or they said the boil, you know, the whirlpools on the river would be so severe that we would be capsized and pulled to the bottom, and then we would be pulled along the mud at the bottom of the river. And we had better prepare our family, because when we emerged on the top of the river, we wouldn't even have our underwear on. You know, it was all, you know, my Brooks Brothers boxing shorts were very upset about this, but it turned out to all be hyperbole, and for a very interesting reason that maybe folks in New Orleans don't know about, but a little bit more upriver they do, which is that everybody along the river has a relative or a friend who has been killed either in tugboat accidents or flooding.
Mm-hmm.
Flooding's very serious down there, as you all know. And so a culture of fear has grown up along the river. And my job as the captain of this vessel was to travel 2,000 miles down the river and learn which fears were legitimate and which fears were not, and just sort of teach myself. The knowledge was sort of within me, but I had to teach myself to which fears to listen to.
And not to show fear, really.
And not to show a lot of fear or be calm.
Yeah.
And yeah, I, you know, the other things happened. I broke my ribs a couple times outside at night on these rock levees, these riprap levees, which are very dangerous. And we were parked there at night and had to get out in the middle of a storm and adjust lines and hurt myself that way. But overall, it was a really wonderful, exhilarating trip.
Washington Post reporter and North Louisiana native Casey Parks in Diary of a Misfit found inspiration in an elusive Southern character, born a woman but lived as a man.
The more I learned about him, the more I wanted to know, in part because most people really didn't know a lot about him. They knew that he mowed lawns for a living. They knew that he wrote songs. And they knew that he lived as a guy, though his anatomy was what they would consider female. And he just was a very isolated person. You know, he didn't date anybody. He didn't seem to have any family. The people who raised him died in the 1950s. He had probably a dozen dogs and cats. So he was kind of peculiar in that way to people. I guess when I first started working on it, I didn't know how my own life was going to turn out. Like, am I going to end up alone forever? And so I think I was initially just trying to learn about him to see, like, what is my life going to be like? And how do you live as someone who's different than everyone else around you?
Even though he did leave a record, it was jealously guarded. And that's one of the problems with reconstructing gay history, don't you think? That's why so much of it gets lost.
Not just gay history, but poor history, I think. I mean,
true.
One of the big issues, I think, in my research that I found is the newspapers of the 1930s, 40s, 50s really only chronicle the lives of rich people. And you can argue to an extent that's true even today, but regular people, their lives do not get recorded in the same way. We as a society don't value them in the same way.
Historian Joan DeJean returned to the colonial era, and there she found fascinating lives to chronicle in Mutinous Women, how a group of French convicts became the founding mothers of the Gulf Coast. Now, I love how many of the New Orleans women ended up living on Bourbon Street.
Yes. Well, about 36 of the women lived in New Orleans in the first years of the city, which is pretty extraordinary. And I'm betting that most of them passed through New Orleans on their way to other places. So New Orleans was really, this is the founding of New Orleans, the actual building of New Orleans. And so many women were there. Bourbon Street was in large part built by these women. The women, the people who owned property on Bourbon Street at first, had literally, they and their husbands, had cleared the land and built the houses. Now, people down there know what land is like. This is not like you chop down a nice little tree and you cut the grass. These were swampland, and they cleared that themselves. And so many of them, and there were at least seven living on Bourbon Street in the first years of Bourbon Street's existence. I'll be happy to give you some examples if you'd like to hear about.
Well, tell about the woman who ended up owning the property where Lafitte's blacksmith shop is today.
It actually was her daughter, but she lived, the woman was called Marie Daudin, and she was from Orleans, France. By accident, she ended up in New Orleans. She married a ship's captain, so a major, important figure, and one of the first men who was able to navigate the Mississippi successfully to get to New Orleans, because the French founded New Orleans without being able to, without having anyone who knew how to sail, get through the Mississippi to get there, but that didn't stop them. Anyway, this man did that. He was killed at Natchez in the uprising in 1729. She remarried. She stayed on Bourbon Street, and a daughter was born of her second marriage to a carpenter on Bourbon Street. And that daughter, Marie-Catherine Laroche, later owned the property that is now Lafitte's blacksmith shop. She also owned the land on which the Omni Orleans Hotel sits. She was a major property owner. She also has left descendants of the original woman, Marie Daudin, through her daughter, has descendants all over the country today. The last group of descendants to get in touch with me live in New Jersey.
The versatile writer Ryan Fertel turned birdwatcher during the pandemic and focused in on the state bird and brown pelican in the Louisiana True series from LSU Press.
I guess one of the lessons I wanted to tell in the book is, like, you know, I've heard the pelican described as resilient. And it's the same word we're often kind of stuck with ourselves living in South Louisiana along the Gulf Coast, this notion of resiliency. And I don't think of the brown pelican as resilient. Like the brown pelican can't do all that much to help itself, right? Mm-hmm. If its habitat is under threat, it can leave, right? But it doesn't always have the resources to make those decisions all the time. And that might take, you know, generations of pelicans for that to happen. So the story of the brown pelican in Louisiana, off the coast of California and the Channel Islands, all throughout Florida, it's a relationship with humanity.
Right.
We are linked with the brown pelican. The brown pelican is linked with us. And I really see it as this creature, this animal, you know, is a wonderful showcase to show like what humanity was doing to the environment at many certain points in time over the past century.
One of my very favorite books this year, The Last Stand of Louisiana Shrimpers by Emma X. Lorette, was a beautifully written study of the shrimping community of Chauvin, Emma's hometown, and simultaneously a lesson in making transitions from ways of life to gender identity. Now, one of the crucial aspects you write about is the idea of unmooring, which is something we have to do in order to move forward, or really to move at all. So talk a little bit about that idea in this culture.
Yeah, thank you for setting me up for unmooring, because it's something I was like thinking about for probably 10 years before I even wrote the book. It was something that I just came across some like old definitions in a nautical manual, and it got me thinking about what it means to let go of things, but not in a way that's like completely disconnected from whatever it is. And like, that's also kind of like my relationship with thinking about where I'm from, still being connected and oriented that way, you know, from my point of origin, but like letting that set me in a certain path toward freedom. So I should probably give a little bit of a definition. I kind of went ahead of it, but unmooring is not to release all of your anchors. It's to release all of your anchors, but one. And the point of it is so that you can steer or orient your boat in a way before releasing the final anchor and setting sail. This is from like when sailing was a primary form of transportation. I sort of used it as this metaphor or theme to think about how we negotiate freedom from what's going on with you. And so like for the shrimpers, one of the things that they're doing in continuing to shrimp, despite the fact that it's not necessarily an industry on the upward swing, is trying to figure out how to survive the structures of capitalism, of the way that things are organized on land, about how we're disciplined into jobs and upward mobility and like a certain type of hope towards an American dream that may or may not even be possible. Here it's like kind of disconnecting from these things and like trying to chart a different type of freedom, for better or worse, right? This isn't to valorize the lifestyle, but it's to try to figure out how we react to things and the kind of ways that we're coping with the struggles that are ahead of us. And so that's how I'm sort of envisioning it. But for me, the core of unmooring is all about this play of freedom and connection and how you can use that to build your own world, one that you feel like you can survive.
There were losses, of course, as there are every year. That venerable Southern scholar, co-founder of the Tennessee Williams Literary Festival, and author of many books, Kenneth Holditch, is gone. Known for his love of Tennessee Williams, his brilliant teaching, and his entertaining French Quarter walking tours. In his straw hat and seersucker suit, he became a great New Orleans character himself. We lost Gwendolyn Milo Hall, whose work in digitizing slave records revolutionized historical research. This is from an interview about her memoir, Haunted by Slavery, A Southern White Woman in the Freedom Struggle. So how did you feel when you finished this book and you look back at all the things you'd done? You know, this was the life you couldn't have imagined when you were a girl. I mean, did you kind of sit back and go, whoa, I've done some stuff, you know? I mean,
well, you know, to tell you the truth, Susan, it's only now in my life when the few really advanced professors and writers about the African diaspora, just a handful of them, the most prestigious now, are beginning to appreciate the work I did, and perhaps I'm doing, I don't know. So. Yeah, and am doing too. It took so long for me to get this little recognition that I'm getting that my main reaction is, I sure am lucky I live to be so old, or I never would have gotten any recognition in my lifetime.
Finally, justification, right? Now, one of the things I loved, you described in this book, a writer's dream of a moment. And it's after Africans in Colonial Louisiana came out and you got on the streetcar and everybody was reading your book.
Well, you know, I'm still amazed that it became such a popular book, because I don't think it's a bit easy to read, and it's long, you know, it's long, it's complicated. Been telling people that, and they say, but it means so much to us. Mm-hmm. It's so original. It makes us look entirely at Louisiana entirely different.
Well, I was having dinner with a friend of mine who's a bookseller the other night, and I told her that story. And she said, that was the book that broke everything open, because everybody did read that book. And we lost Billy Southern too soon. Known for his determined work in capital defense cases, he was also one of New Orleans' finest writers, and his Down in New Orleans, Reflections from a Drowned City, collected his post-Katrina dispatches. Albert Woodfox, who served the longest time in solitary confinement of any incarcerated American, the last of the Angola Three to be released from prison, is gone too. We remember the power of his book, Solitary, My Story of Transformation and Hope. Now, I think the first thing anybody thinks when you hear about someone who has spent 23 hours a day for 43 years and 10 months alone in a space that's 6 by 9 feet, and you survived, is just how did you do it? And I was so moved reading this book by the way you described the strategies you had to adopt. You had to tamp down your emotions. You had to try and take an intellectual approach to everything. And you educated yourself, yes. You know, and that was an uplifting and beautiful part of this book, and there are many parts. And I wondered if you'd read that little beginning of the chapter, My Greatest Achievement.
My greatest achievement, after years in prison and solitary confinement, I had experienced all the emotions the Louisiana Department of Public Safety and Correction wanted from me. Anger, bitterness, the thirst to see someone suffer, the way I was suffering, the revenge factor, all that. But I also became something they didn't want or expect. Self-educated, I could lose myself in a book. Reading was a bright spot for me. Reading was my salvation. Libraries and universities and schools from all over Louisiana donated books to Angola. And for once, the willful ignorance of the prison administration paid off for us, because there were a lot of radical books in the prison library, books we wouldn't even be allowed to get through the mail, books we never could have afforded to buy, books we had never heard of. Herman King and I first gravitated to books and the authors that dealt with politics and race. George Jackson, Frantz Fanon, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Steve Biko, Eldridge Cleaver, Soul on Ice. J.A. Rogers, from Superman to Man. We read anything we could find on slavery, communism, socialism, Marxism, anti-imperialism, the African independent movements, and independent movements from around the world. I would check off these books on the library order form and never expect to get them until they came. Leaning against my wall in the cell, sitting on the floor, on my bed, or at my table, I read.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jamie Attenberg reads from his son's the paperback of I Came All This Way to Meet You, Tuesday, January 3rd from 6 to 8 at Bar Pomona, 2352 St. Claude Avenue. Ellen Hardiman discusses and signs her memoir, Pioneering in New Orleans Television, Memoir of a Starstruck Kid, Wednesday, January 4th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Two local writers will make presentations for other writers Saturday, January 7th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The sessions for beginners or experienced writers are free of charge, open to the public. At 9:30 a.m., Bill Lofelm discusses cultivating suspense in your work, followed by Rolf Van Anders at 11 a.m., who will discuss yoga and the power of creativity. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.